Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. And there's a reason the second Friday in January is known as Quitter's Day. That's because it's how long most of us keep our New Year's resolutions. About half of Americans say they make resolutions, vowing to lose weight, exercise more, quit a bad habit, or be smarter with money. But less than 2 in 10 are successful in achieving their goals. Why is it so hard to change our behavior? Here to help us answer that question is University of Oregon psychology professor Elliot Berkman. He directs the university's neuroscience lab and studies the neuroscience of psychology goals, motivation, and behavior change. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Berkman.
Thank you, Amy.
So most people break their New Year's resolutions. I'm sure that doesn't surprise you.
No.
So your lab studies goals, motivations, self-regulation. Why is it that, or like, what does the latest research tell us about why it is so hard to change behavior, to actually keep a resolution?
Well, there are a number of factors. One thing that I think about quite a bit is that it is difficult to sustain motivation for longer than a week or two, as many of your listeners are noting or have learned in the past. And the work in my lab has really focused on this peculiar fact that most of the resolutions that people set for themselves around New Year are things that are mechanically easy to do. I think people really understand what it means to be physically active, to eat more healthily, to change spending habits. The kind of technical aspects of those kinds of behaviors are not tricky. It's not like learning to play some really complicated game or, you know, learning some new mathematical skill. And so what really determines failure there is that people cannot sustain the motivation to continue to change. One of the oldest lessons from the goals literature is that goals that are motivated internally, or what we would call intrinsically motivated goals, will be sustained longer than extrinsically motivated goals. So goals that are extrinsic are things that are set from the outside.
Yeah, give me an example of each so I can understand that.
Yeah. An extrinsic goal would be that you go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, you need to start exercising more. So it's not something that you necessarily want to do or you care about for reasons that are associated with your core important values and goals that you hold personally. That would be an intrinsic goal. Extrinsic is something that somebody else tells you to do, or something that you're kind of coming to because of social pressure, which is, I think, very common for New Year's resolutions. People might not be quite ready to change yet, but that somebody, you know, they feel pressure to do it. And so that's kind of a classic extrinsic goal. And we know very well that goals motivated for that reason are much more likely to fail quickly.
Okay, so if you feel pressured to do it or you're told to do it, but in your brain you haven't said, I want to do this, then you're more likely.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. So-called Quitter's Day is the second Friday in January, so it means people are giving up very quickly. Does the research bear this out? We can't even make it a whole month?
Well, yes and no. I think some of the more recent literature I've seen shows New Year's resolutions lasting, you know, maybe a month. So those estimates vary and they depend on the type of goal that people are pursuing. But I think, you know, zooming out a little bit, the takeaway message is that it's really hard to sustain goals that are pursued for somewhat arbitrary reasons, like the date on the calendar.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you this hour. Have you made a resolution in the past and stuck to it? Can you give us a call and tell us your secret. How did you stick to your resolution? Call us at 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with the University of Oregon psychology professor, Elliot Berkman, about why it's so hard to change our behaviors and stick with a goal. And so, you know, honestly, Elliot, this time of year, social media is just full of the new year, new you stuff. It is everywhere. And I find it kind of overwhelming and sometimes even disheartening. Do you have any advice on how to handle feeling disappointed that you didn't keep a resolution?
Yeah, that's a great question. I agree with you completely. And the literature bears that out. I think more and more it's becoming apparent that New Year's resolutions is really are kind of unfortunate, unproductive. Some might even say toxic for the reasons that you're pointing to. So, you know, it sounds odd as a goal researcher, but one of the best advice is you really have to pick your spots and And I would say for most people, don't set New Year's resolutions. We know empirically, we know from the data that almost all the time they fail. Even if they're successful, they're short-lived. And so, honestly, for most people, the right choice is to not set resolutions. To the extent that you're going to set them, you want to make sure that you really are motivated, that you really are ready to change. One of the best predictors of success is a simple measure. It's really just one question. It depicts a ladder. And it says sort of along the different rungs of this ladder, where would you place yourself? So maybe the bottom rung is, I have a goal, but I'm really not, I haven't made any plans at all. Like I kind of want to do this one day. The next l rung would be like, well, I have plans and I think I'm going to start doing this, next month. The third rung says something like, I'm ready to change and I've, taken some action to start going, that kind of thing. And so you really need to be at the very top of that ladder, to, that you're ready to commit, you understand what you're getting into, you have concrete plans for the first, little while, the goal pursuit. Otherwise, it's a signal to yourself that you're just not ready. And in fact, when you start trying to change anyway at that point, it is demotivating and because you're more likely to fail and it's going to make it harder in the long run.
So I've seen a lot of the New Year, New You stuff on social media, but then I've also seen a lot of people saying, "Down with the New Year's resolution, don't do it." And the new trend seems to be to create a bingo card or a vision board instead of making a resolution. So it's a bingo card where you have to fill, because there's lots of things on it. I don't know how many slots are on a bingo card off the top of my head, but you have to, I mean, it's 20 or 25. You have to fill it out. And it's just a bunch of goals, but they can't all be lose 30 pounds, right? So, what do you think of the bingo card? Would that be better, for changing behavior?
Maybe. I mean, it sounds a little bit kind of that sounds even harder to some extent because you're doing multiple things at once. We could circle back to that. One thing that you can do that's borne out by in the scientific literature is to start making plans. It's not it, it it's sort of a less intimidating first step. Right, to say, look, I'm not quite ready to change yet. I'm not ready to pull the trigger, but what I can do is start to think through what is that going to look like? What is the first week, the first month, whatever your goal might be? And this is something that people have thought about and studied quite a bit. And the technical term in the literature is implementation intentions. Implementation intentions are concrete plans that help you deal with barriers along the way. So if my goal is to quit smoking, I might have an implementation intention that says, okay, that first time that I go out, to the bar, to the restaurant, and someone offers me a cigarette, or the end of the meal comes and it's time to have a cigarette, what am I going to do? Like, here is exactly what I'm going to say. No, thank you. I'm quitting and put a piece of gum in my mouth instead, or something like that. Like, the more concrete, the better. And really planning out those first few weeks can help when you start to change your behavior.
In defense of the bingo board, these bingo cards that I'm seeing are not like giant goals. They're fun things like go to a sporting event, go to a movie with a friend, eat dinner by yourself at a restaurant, things like that. So I'm not, those aren't resolutions, but that's what people are trying to do. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it does. Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, those sound like tactics or just kind of fun things someone might want to do. I'm always happy. People should go out and live their lives. That sounds great.
Do you make New Year's resolutions?
No, I generally don't.
You spend so much time studying them, you're like, no, absolutely not.
Usually I'm unteachable, but this is one thing that after about 20 years of doing this, I've learned.
Okay, so you are conducting research right now with smoking cessation programs called ASH, Altering Smoking Habits. And you just talked about that a little bit. But the participants, there's more science to it than just, having a piece of gum with you all the time. So participants are going to go through brain scans. What are you hoping to learn?
Well, one of the things that we're coming into this project with is this idea that there's no one strategy that works for everyone. And so our thinking in this project, and I should note, this is a collaboration with Ohio State's own Kentaro Ken Fujita in the Department of Psychology there. And what Ken and I are thinking is that we yes, we think different strategies should work for different people, and we're trying to push that to the next level and say, well, is there something that we could learn about somebody at the beginning, at the outset, and say, oh, for you, strategy A might work for strategy better than strategy B. And then for a different person, oh, maybe strategy C would work better than strategy B. So, without getting into the details of what we're doing, we're trying to look at that and then using brain scans to understand how well these different strategies are working and to kind of compare them across different people.
So to see if the brain lights up in one way, if you give them one idea versus another, something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we have a hypothesis about what the underlying motivational systems are. Our next idea is that regardless of what particular strategy works, rather, for example, if it's implementation intentions versus thinking about your high-level values, and regardless of which one works, if it works, we think that they will all operate by increasing motivation to change the goal, and we think we can measure that using a brain scans.
You're also conducting a healthy eating study involving higher weight individuals. You note that behavioral weight loss programs rarely produce lasting weight loss and eating behavior change. Why is that? Why do these programs not work long term?
It's a great question. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's emerging from the nutrition literature that unfortunately hasn't made its way out into the popular discourse yet. But essentially, diets don't work. If anything, dieting will create metabolic changes in your body that will make it harder to lose weight or make you more likely to gain weight in the long run. So there's this kind of rebound effect that's counterproductive. There are many reasons for that. But one of the reasons is that, often people have cravings for food, and it's w when you try to deny those cravings, one of the things that can happen is that they come back even stronger. And so we're using lessons from what we've learned about emotion and how people regulate their emotions to help people deal with those cravings. And then the other thing that study does a little differently is that the focus really is not on weight loss per se. The focus is on eating more healthily. So focusing on what is it that you are trying to do nutritionally. And usually the ultimate goal there is, increasing how many fruits and vegetables you eat rather than weight loss per se, because that, all of the kind of beneficial health effects really do seem to be on what you're eating rather than how much you actually weigh.
How do you see drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy changing the weight loss landscape? Because do they really change behavior? They're a drug that decreases food cravings, right?
They do. They change your appetite, so they do change behavior. I and I think a lot of folks in the nutrition world are concerned about what the potential long-term effects are on people metabolically. We also don't know really what the long-term kind of health outcomes might be, but certainly for people that need those drugs, they seem to work. I mean, I think at this point it's a little premature to say. I think, frankly, we know that they produce weight loss, at least in the short run. But the history of the weight loss, industry, which goes back more than 100 years, is littered with many kind of miracle drugs that also produce short-term weight loss that we've kind of, in retrospect, decided were not a great idea. So, just kind of as an amateur historian of this kind of thing, I'm highly skeptical. But we have to admit, the data do show that they generate weight loss.
I come from the a shake for breakfast, a shake for lunch, and a sensible dinner generation. So,
Yes.
yeah. So I
Remember
can't.
Fen-Phen?
Yeah. Well, but also I can't. I mean, we don't really know. There's so many people. I feel like the number of people taking Ozempic, Wegovy, all those. There's like three or four different names, but the number of people taking them has increased so much so quickly that there aren't enough people who have gone off of it to even know what is going to happen, right?
That's right. I mean, and people have been taking these drugs for a longer time, not necessarily for weight loss, right, but for other conditions. And so there is some amount of evidence there on the kind of, let's call it, medium-term outcomes. But again, I fear that a lot of the focus is a little myopic on are they working in terms of producing weight loss and not on the larger question of, well, wait a second, are they actually making people more healthy, right? We've equated losing weight with healthiness, and that's simply not true. I would much rather a drug that, helps people eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, regardless of what their body looks like.
Well, and we have just about a minute left. So you already said that you don't make resolutions, and people shouldn't make resolutions. So, what do you feel about, in this new year, we're in a new year, what kind of goals should people set that might actually stick?
Well, they should set goals that are aligned with their core values. I think it's always a useful exercise to take a moment and, a lot of mindfulness practices have components that are like this, where you take a moment and just think about what really motivates you in life. If you think or you have the hunch that, oh, I should be pursuing this or that goal, ask yourself why, right? Why is it that I want to lose weight, or why is it that I want to exercise more, right? What is the ultimate end? And you can actually ask that question a number of times, right? Well, I want to lose weight because I think I'll look better. Okay, why do I think I'll look better, right? Well, for this or that, right? Really kind of push. And eventually, at some point, you'll get to a higher level motivation, right? Often it's something like, well, because I want to live longer so that I can, see my family grow, things like that, right? And think about what are the behaviors that really promote those ultimate core values that we hold. And the other thing I'd encourage people to do at the kind of lower level is to look at your habits, right? What are those day-to-day habits, and ask whether those habits are really aligned with the kinds of core values that you've identified for yourself.
Thank you so much for your time. That's University of Oregon psychology professor Elliot Berkman. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, a dietitian and nutrition coach is going to talk about some ways to succeed. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. And there's a reason the second Friday in January is known as Quitter's Day. That's because that's how long most of us actually keep our New Year's resolutions. About half of Americans say they make New Year's resolutions, but less than 2 in 10 are successful at achieving their goals. Topping that resolution list? Health-related goals and pledges to lose weight, eat healthier, and exercise more. Today, we're talking about how to succeed. Alyssa Rumsey is a registered dietitian and nutritionist. She's the author of the book Unapologetic Eating: Making Peace with Food and Transform Your Life. She works to help people accept and revere their bodies, no matter the shape and size. Welcome to All Sides, Alyssa.
Thank you, Amy. I'm happy to be here.
So New Year's resolutions tend to focus on ways to get healthier, but you're a big proponent of acceptance, telling people to stop fixing things, stop fixing your weight, your body, your appearance, yourself. What do you think about it when people make New Year's resolutions to be healthier?
I think for some people, having an intention or having goals can be really helpful. I think the problem ends up becoming that a lot of these, as you said, so many fail. And a lot of that is because they end up being very ambitious or big sweeping changes or things that are very external driven rather than coming from a place of, okay, how can I take better care of myself? What does that look like, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally? And so we tend to see these unrealistic goals and starting out the year with all this energy. And then as soon as, real life hits, we see this sense of guilt of like, oh, I'm not doing well. So just, okay, I'm not going to let go of these.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you this hour. Have you made a resolution to be healthier, maybe? Have you made a resolution in the past and actually stuck to it? What's your secret? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, how would you advise people to approach self-improvement from a more positive angle? How do we reframe the resolution into this positive self-improvement approach?
Well, I think doing a little bit of reflection first of, as you mentioned, a lot of the goals tend to be around health, and that often what I see that boil down to is weight, gym, eating healthier, which again can all be positive for some people, but doing a little check-in for yourself of, okay, how do I want to take better care of myself this year? What might physical health look like for me? What might better mental or emotional health look like for me? And then considering, what is important to me? Like maybe it's, okay, yes, I would like to lose some weight, but really what's behind that is I'd like to be able to keep up with my kids or my grandkids, or I'd like to be able to go upstairs easier. So really trying to get to the root of what you're looking to improve. And then really thinking about it from a more smaller change, more attainable, rather than, if you're not really doing much movement and then your goal is to go to the gym 4 or 5 days a week, no wonder that that's not really going to work that well. So how can we break that down into smaller, more realistic goals?
When you talk to clients at this time of year, this beginning of the new year reset, what do you hear the most that people are hoping to work on?
I think weight loss is a big one. And generally, with that comes increased fitness or moving more, as well as eating healthier. But again, those tend to be sort of pretty broad and looked at more from an external place rather than, okay, let's take a look at where you're at now. What is your goal with eating healthier? What is your goal with moving more? What do you hope the outcome is going to be? Because, the thing with weight loss is, weight loss is not a behavior, and it's an outcome, but it's an outcome that we don't have that much control over. And often what I see happen is people set these weight loss goals and then they make these really positive behavior changes with moving more and eating better. And then if the weight isn't doing what they want, then they're like, oh, well, this isn't working. And they let go of the positive behavior change. So I think trying to think about, okay, what is the outcome I'm hoping for? But really, what's like underneath that outcome? And how can I really be in the process of this a little bit more?
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and our guest right now is Alyssa Rumsey, a registered dietitian and nutritionist. Your book is called Unapologetic Eating: Making Peace with Food and Transform Your Life. And you write on your blog that eating should be pleasurable. So, how do feelings of guilt and shame get in the way? Because I mean, I can name to you the most pleasurable foods, and I know they're not good for me, but yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of times what happens is for so many people, just given the culture that we live in, eating and having pleasure with eating is associated with guilt and shame of like, oh, well, when I ask people their favorite foods, usually it's something very similar to what you just said of like, oh, well, I love X, Y, and Z, but like, oh, that's not good for me. And what ends up happening is that when we kind of have this black and white or all or nothing thinking of like, okay, this is healthy eating, this is unhealthy eating, this is not good for me. Our bodies have this very strong survival instinct. And whenever there's any type of restriction, like, okay, well, I shouldn't have these things, or I'm going to start the new year and I'm going to cut out sugar. Our bodies have this natural drive to want the thing that we're putting off limits. And this is evolutionary, right? So for those of us who are food secure, we have plenty of food, but our body doesn't know that. It's still wired. Our nervous systems are wired from thousands and thousands of years ago when food was scarce. And so when we set up these binaries of like, okay, no, I can't have this, generally what people find is that they're able to not eat, let's say, sugar for a little bit, but then at some point there's a tipping point and the pendulum fully swings the other way and it's a full-on like, okay, I just can't stop eating cookies or cupcakes or ice cream or whatever it is. And I always say that makes so much sense. And that's not a problem with your willpower. Usually people think like, oh, this is my fault. I can't control myself. And I'm like, no, that's your body doing what it's actually supposed to do. So if we can take a step back and really think about, okay, all foods can be on the table. And then coming from a place of what makes me feel best? Yeah. Eating, a whole pint of ice cream does not make me feel physically my best. So how can I kind of put it on, not making it fully off limits, like allowing it in some sense, and Again, this is not easy, especially if you've been keeping these things off limits for a while. I generally recommend that people start with like one or two things they've been keeping off limits and start to add them in. But when we can really take guilt and shame out of the picture, that's where we see behavior change happen. Because guilt and shame, you know, Brené Brown talks a lot about this in her work about shame. Shame is not a good motivator for change. Shame keeps us stuck. It keeps us, you know, I said before, of like, oh, I'm not losing weight. So, like, screw it. I'm not gonna keep up with these things, right? It doesn't actually lead to positive behavior change. So, if we can really look at, okay, how can I, this makes sense that I'm having these cravings. I haven't been letting myself have these things. And more approaching it from a place of what foods make me feel my best? What can I add into my diet? So that's what I love. I love setting goals with people about what to add in versus what to take away. What can I add in that's going to be helpful to me and my health?
So, yeah, the idea of cutting something out completely just doesn't work. And so, diets like what is it called? The keto diet, where you completely eliminate carbs, right? Of all kinds. Is that works, but I've seen people, they drop weight, but it doesn't last. Is that what happens?
Exactly. Exactly. These things tend to not be sustainable for the vast majority of people. When we look at actually like the research and the data, we see that like 95-ish percent of people in the long term are not able to sustain these changes. And again, it makes so much sense when we think about from an evolutionary perspective what's going on in our body. And so it might work in the short term. Usually that's what I hear from a lot of people of like, okay, I've tried all these things, the keto diet, you know, whatever other diet. It worked for a little while. And then, you know, stuff hit the fan and now it's not sustainable. And then I swung the whole other way and then I gained back the weight and I gained back more. And now I'm at this worse off spot. That's a story I hear all the time.
It's funny for you to say that it's in us from, thousands of years ago when food was scarce, because like cheese fries and chips and queso, that wasn't around back then, right? So like why do I crave that, right?
Yeah, it wasn't around back then, but if you think about it, like if we were in a famine, if we were like back in the hunter-gatherer days when there wasn't a lot of food around, what was going to make the most sense to eat? High calorie, high fat, high sugar, because that's going to give you the most bang for your buck. If food is really scarce and you're not sure when your next food is coming from, that's the
Oh,
stuff that gives you the most bang for your buck.
the
So
delicious
this
stuff is
is,
the stuff of saving your life. Okay.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of counterintuitive right nowadays because that's not the situation we're in, which is why I think it's helpful to think about this, you know, from before, but also coming back to like, okay, yeah, cheese fries, if I eat them every day. And what people find, if they give themselves permission to eat cheese fries, let's say, every day, my guess is that after like 5 or 6 days, you're going to be like, don't show me a cheese fry. Like, I don't want to see a cheese fry again, right? And that's what we call habituation. We get used to the food being around, and then it's not as desirable.
And then we switch to queso, right? And then we'll switch to and then we'll switch to ice cream, and then we'll, yeah, well, I'm sure we could talk more about that. I'm going to go to a caller. Julianne in Reynoldsburg called in to talk about a success story. Julianne, thanks for calling All Sides.
Welcome to, and I look forward to more shows, Amy.
Oh, thank you. So
And
what resolution did you stick with?
well, I was in a training program that was going to include briefings and the like, and I was not good and terrified of public speaking. So my resolution was to become more comfortable and to take steps to do so. And my first step was to join Toastmasters. And I've kept that for over 20 years.
What is that? I don't know what that is.
Toastmasters. It's a speaking organization.
Okay, so you joined a group to help you with your public speaking.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that call, Julianne. And you've succeeded in your public speaking because you just talked on the radio here. So good job, right? Thank you so
Have
much
a
for you.
wonderful new year.
Yes, thank you for your call. So, what do you think of that, the idea of joining a group to help you? Do you, what is that, how does that work?
I think that's such a great idea, no matter what your resolution is. I think having community around us, people that are going through something similar. So that caller, right, wanted public speaking. I'm familiar with Toastmasters. I've had some friends and colleagues that have done it. And it's all people who are in the same spot. And I think no matter what your goal is, joining some sort of community or finding some sort of community can be really helpful. My team and I have run support groups in the past at this time of year for people that are kind of going through the same thing. And it can be really helpful just to hear that you're not alone and to have that support and that place to check in week after week and get some more support with your goals.
And this seems from a while ago, but like going to those Weight Watchers meetings where they used to actually have in-person meetings to talk with others, I've heard that that has helped some people, but it's been a while.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the reasons why Weight Watchers has been so successful is because they had that model of in-person and community-based support. And I know when I've set goals, health related or not, just having some sort of way to show up. Like, for example, one of mine has been to get back into yoga. And I have some friends that we say, okay, we're going to meet at this yoga class on Wednesday night. And especially now in the winter, I live in New York City, so it's dark at like 4:30 p.m. It's snowing right now. If it was just me going, there's no way I would go. But if I know, okay, I'm meeting these people, that's going to get me out the door. So trying to find ways to build in that community can be really helpful.
Yeah, gym memberships typically spike in January, and then regular attendance tapers off throughout the year. On your blog, you write about you don't call it exercise, but you call it joyful movement. So, what is joyful movement as opposed to exercise?
Well, I think a lot of people have not a great relationship to exercise. When I ask people what they think about exercise, they're like, well, I know it's good for me, but I don't like doing it. And so, joyful movement, and that's a little bit of a misnomer because I'm not necessarily expecting that everybody is going to like love going to the gym or love doing certain types of movement. But really, it's about, again, coming back to yourself rather than, oh, I should run, or I should lift weights, or I should do this. It's coming back to yourself and thinking, okay, is there anything that I enjoy? What does feel less of like a heavy lift to go do? What feels best in my body? And that can shift over time. When I was younger, I loved running. I loved lifting weights. As I've gotten older, that's just not what feels good in my body anymore. That's not what gives me energy. That's not what feels the best for me. So it's really kind of coming back to yourself and thinking, what does feel fun and enjoyable to some extent, at least. And that can often mean trying to try new things. Maybe it is going to the gym, but for a lot of people, it's not. A lot of people, it's finding, a dance class or putting music on in their living room or finding someone to go to yoga with or finding someone in your neighborhood to go walk with on a regular basis. So it doesn't have to be going to the gym. Some people enjoy going to the gym, which is great, but it doesn't have to look like that, which is why I try to reframe it away from exercise, in part because people have very like rigid ideas of what that means.
Yeah, I joined a gym a few months ago, and people always ask me, do you like it? And I say, well, like is a strong word, right? What I like to do is sit on the couch or stay in bed, right? But I'm going, and I am enjoying the workout that it is because it's different than anything that I've ever done before. So sometimes, maybe you just need a change. Maybe you need to change it up. Can you get stuck in a rut too?
Oh, absolutely. I think changing it up is great. I also think, thinking about what we were talking about before, about what is your goal for doing this? Because a lot of times when weight loss or like changing body shape or size is the motivation, that's also where I see these movement goals not being sustainable versus I want to have more energy. And yes, I sitting on my couch, especially right now in the dead of winter, is absolutely sounds more fun to me. And I know that when I get out of the house, even if it's for like 20 or 30 minutes and move my body in some way, I have more energy. I've been struggling with back pain and hip pain for a couple of years. And I know if I just sit around all week long, that is so much worse. And so those are the motivators that get me, whether it's to the gym or going out to walk in my neighborhood. So, kind of again, having those more internal motivations is going to be helpful in keeping it sustainable, as well as we haven't really talked about this, but being flexible. So not letting missing one day at the gym or 1 week or 2 weeks at the gym put you back to square one, saying, well, screw it, I messed up. So how can we have this flexibility and keep kind of coming back to ourselves of like, okay, yeah, I haven't been in a couple of weeks and I know it's going to help make me feel better.
And we have about less than a minute left, but do you make New Year's resolutions, or have you in the past, or do you currently? What do you think that, like, a new year is a new you, new time thing? Does that work at all, ever?
You know, again, I think it's very individual. I have in the past, there's some years where I feel it's helpful to set some sort of intention. There's other years where I'm just like, nope, like that feels more stressful than not. So I'm not going to do it this year. So I think it's really kind of checking in with yourself. If the idea of making it feels helpful, awesome. If the idea of making it feels exhausting or stressful, listen to your gut. Don't do it.
That's Alyssa Rumsey, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and author. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about New Year's resolutions and money matters. Spend less, save more. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Money has been on a lot of our minds this year. We've experienced higher prices at the grocery store, worried about inflation, and fretted over making ends meet. A new year is a good time to reassess your finances and figure out smart strategies. Here to help us do that is Washington Post journalist Michelle Singletary. She writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column, The Color of Money. She's also the author of several books. Welcome to All Sides, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written that you are a fan of New Year's resolutions and goal setting. So even though most people break resolutions, why do you think that they're a good thing?
I think every year, or whenever you set a goal, it's a chance to get it right, a chance to change. And so I embrace that. And, you know, even if you fail, there are lessons in failure. And, you know, I take a lesson from inventors. I mean, they could have an experiment that they do 100 times and the 101st one time, you know, they get it right. And so I look at it that way. You try and try again, but at least you're trying. And that's what resolutions say to me, that I maybe messed up, maybe I did get reach my goals, but I'm going to try again this year.
So you're the author of four books. That includes What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a survival guide, and also The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom. So if you are talking to people about the 21-day financial fast, I mean, that seems like something you could make a New Year's resolution around, because if most people break their New Year's resolutions in the first month, you know, in 21 days, you can get it in, right?
That's exactly right. You know, the book was inspired by a ministry I have at my church. So it's a faith-based fast, kind of modeled on lots of religious organizations at the beginning of the year might do a food fast, like they're going to fast from, you know, meats and sweets and things like that. And I thought, well, you know what? What if I shut everybody down for 3 weeks? You can't buy anything that is not a necessity, and you can't use your credit or debit card. And people are like, well, wait a minute.
Wait a
card.
Minute.
I know, right? See, there you go, right?
Who has cash? Where do I get that?
Well, that's right. You know, a lot of kids probably have never seen cash. They're like, what is this, mommy? And so the reason why, two parts of this. The stop shopping, because a lot of us are unconscious consumers. We buy, and then a day or two later, we can't even remember what we bought. Or you have, like, if you put it on a credit card, I've done this experiment. I've asked people, without looking at their charges, look at the total and tell me everything that you bought. Some people can't even remember from the month. They certainly can't remember 3 or 4 months ago. And with a debit card, we know that studies show that when you use plastic, either, you know, credit or debit, you tend to not pay attention to how much you're spending because it's easier to hand that over. And so I want to get people accustomed to what it means to be limited by cash. So certainly I'm not going to tell you to take out $1,000 from the bank, but if you know that your grocery bill should only be, say, $100 a trip, and you take that $100, you're going to spend within that $100. Mm-hmm. But if you take your debit card and say you have $200 in your account, you're going to be grabbing things from because you're saying, well, I've got the money in the bank. It doesn't limit you. And that's what I want people to do. And it's such a short period of time, but it's enough time to give people a wake-up call. People who have done the fast have realized how much they were eating out. One couple, just with that 21-day financial fast, realized, looking at the previous month and two, spent about $1,500 eating out for their family of four. $1,500. At the same time telling me they didn't have enough money to put in their kids' college fund or save for retirement.
But DoorDash is just so easy, Michelle.
It's so easy.
I know.
It's so easy.
Yeah, things have just gotten easier. Yeah.
It has. You know, and listen, I'm the mom of three kids. And so kids that were in sports and after school activities, and it becomes so easy to, like, let's just grab something before the activity or afterwards rather than going home. But doing the fast myself, well, I used to pack stuff and snacks, and my car looks like a little grocery store. And so if the kids want anything, it's like, look at the back seat. There's some crackers or something. And you get them used to it, to not always trying to buy something. And when you go to the store, you go to get two items and you come out with 10. But if you had to use cash or you were doing the fast, it makes you really think about it. And the point of the fast is not to stop your consumption, but to make you a more conscious consumer and then put your money where your values are. Right? Do you want to pay off your house before you retire? Do you want to try to send your kids to college with no debt or the least amount of debt? Mm-hmm. But a lot of times life gets in the way of that and other things take our money that we don't intend for it to do.
Yeah, interest rates get in the way of that, man. The interest rates really got me over the past 2 years, I can tell you that much. You wrote last year about this time, you wrote a column and the headline was "Getting Better with Money Starts with Taking Care of Yourself." How are those two things connected?
Well, you know, first of all, and I have learned this the hard way, I am one of those people that is a workaholic, staying up late working, can't say no to people because I want to help and overextending myself or, you know, bailing out relatives who don't need bailing out or shouldn't be bailed out because they need to suffer. And so if you take a pause and think about your health, and well-being and being able to say no, you'll actually have more money and be more healthy because our health is connected to our wealth. Talk to anybody in their senior years, the cost of health care, and a lot of the things that are wrong with us because of our lifestyle. And my best friend used to ask me, you know, I do a lot of things. I have a ministry at a church. This column, I write books, I do speaking engagements. She said, I don't know how you do it all. And I realized, you know how I did it? I wasn't sleeping. I would be up till 1 or 2 o'clock and then get up at 6 o'clock. I mean, crazy, right? And it's catching up to me. I have some health challenges now. And I'm learning to set a bedtime. I have it on my clock, you know, 11 o'clock, it really should be 10. But then it buzzes off. And I'm like, time to go to bed.
Yeah.
Or time to pause, to meditate, or, you know, read scripture, or do something that calms me down and fills my soul up. And because if you give everything to someone else, there is nothing left for you. And the best example, some of your listeners have probably heard this example, is that when I flew for the first time as a new parent with my infant child, I remember the flight attendant saying, when the oxygen mask drops down, put it on yourself first. And my immediate reaction was, she is crazy. I am going to take care of my baby first. That's what a mother does. I'm going to put it on my baby first. And as she was explaining that when you put it on yourself first, you then have the oxygen, the ability to help the person sit next to you who is a child or acting like a child. And it made sense that way, because if I'm gasping for air, and the same thing with your finances. If you're gasping for air, How can you help somebody else? If you are a parent out there, you're giving to adult children who haven't practiced good money habits and you're constantly bailing them out, then they're not breathing and you are using your resources and you're going to be gaspy and neither one of you are going to be better off. And so that's what I mean by that. Like, take care of yourself, make sure your finances are straight, and that when you are helping other people, you're truly giving them a hand up and not a hand out. There's a difference between the two of those.
We got an email from Mary Beth who said that she kept a past resolution. When she was having a rough year, she resolved to write down one good thing that happened each day. And she found that very helpful. And I like that. I mean, you could even write one good thing you did with your money each day.
I love that. In fact, I might take that and do a column on that. So thank you, Mary Beth. That's exactly right. Because what she's talking about is gratitude. I just wrote a column about New Year's resolutions and I ended it by saying gratitude is cost effective. Because if you take time to think about what you have already, you're not running out there buying more stuff. You're not thinking, I need a bigger house. I need a better car because I see somebody else with that. Gratitude will save you money. And so if every day you wrote down, I'm glad I have a roof over my head. Maybe part of it is leaking, but it's still a roof. I'm glad that I have food on my table. Maybe I can't go out and eat, but I have enough in my house to sustain me. My car might be a little hoopty, but it still gets me from point A to point B. So no, I don't need to go on and buy a new car. And gratitude is just so helpful, particularly for people who have a lot. You know, the people who I had the most trouble saving and preparing for their future is people who have money. Because if you don't have money, you already on a budget. You already, you know, making it from paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
But it's the people who earn well, who think that they're doing well, but when you look at their net worth statement, they have a negative net worth statement, or so much of their monthly income is going to service debt.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Washington Post personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary. And you also suggest that people can, maybe instead of a resolution, you can create a vision board. So if someone has a goal of getting out of debt, what would you tell them to put on their vision board?
Now, this is going to sound interesting because people ask me that all the time. So on your vision board, don't just put the debt because that's so negative, right? So they might have put all the stuff that they bought with the debt as a sort of a motivation. But what I would say is put on what you would want to use that money for that is not going to debt. And use that as inspiration to get out of debt, right? Because that gives you a goal, not just to not have that debt, but what else could I be doing using that money? In the ministry that I run in my church, we have people put together what are called a debt dash, how you pay your debt off. And I recommend starting off with the debt with the smallest balance first. Now, the math whiz out there, people are like, oh, look at the highest interest rate credit card. But you're not looking at behavioral economics. There's a whole, science of that. Because we don't, consumers don't act the way we think they should. On paper, it makes more sense to go after the debt with the highest interest rate. But in practice, what people often don't do is they don't have an immediate success, and then they lose hope, and they stop. So if you get rid of the small debt, say it's $200, you're thinking, whoa, I now have one less debt. Then that energizes them to speed up the debt payment, and they don't actually end up paying more in interest because they've gotten rid of the debt quicker. And so when I do have people do the debt dash, I have them look at the total amount that they're servicing debt. And we're talking hundreds of dollars, sometimes thousands of dollars. Imagine if you had that money to put towards your goal. So on your vision board, if you have children, put on college and them walking across the stage with their diploma and no debt. Put on there, I can retire before I need a walker. or I can maybe change careers because I'm locked into a career that I hate, that is sucking me of my joy. I could change that and be in a career that maybe doesn't make as much, but has more fulfillment. Put that on your vision board. So on one side, put what you could do with that cash that is being used to service debt. And then on the other side, put a copy of that credit card bill. Put a copy of that mortgage statement. Put a copy on that auto loan. And then look at the other side, where if you didn't have that debt, what you could have instead. I no longer have, my husband and I have no debt. We don't have a mortgage. He retired about a year and a half ago. And one of our goals on our vision board was to pay off our home before either one of us retired. And I wrote a column about that. People lost their mind because I had a mortgage of 2.75. And people were like, oh my gosh, this woman don't know what she's talking about. How could you get rid of that kind of cheap debt? But it helped our cash flow. My husband has not, we have not had to tap his retirement account because of that. And it makes sense for us.
Well, and my takeaway from this conversation is that gratitude will save you money. So I want to say, I wrote that down. That's Washington Post personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.